Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and my mission every week is to bring you the most interesting entrepreneurs and business people, authors, speakers, darn near anybody that I can find who are excited to freely share their business wisdom, their tips, their actionable advice, and honestly, most of the time, their story, how they got from where they were to where they are now, and how you can kind of follow along. So today I welcome to the show Deb Calvert. She is the author of Discover Questions, which is trademarked. It's a book series, and she founded People First Productivity Solutions in 2006 to help businesses build organizational strength by putting people first. What a concept, huh? The PFPS focus is to boost company productivity through people development, and this work includes sales, training, coaching and consulting, leadership program design and facilitation, strategic planning with senior managers, team effectiveness work, and executive coaching. Deb has also worked in, trained for, and been featured as a keynote in a wide variety of industries, and she has particular expertise in the produce, agriculture, and media industries, and we're going to talk about that because that's a wide range there. She has also worked with private and public companies of all sizes, and has helped family-owned businesses and startups survive and thrive in a very tough economic climate. She lives in California, so you kind of get where that's coming from. Things are pretty tough there sometimes. So prior to starting her own company, Deb worked in senior-level sales, operations, and human resources roles for a Fortune 500 company. Her unique mix of experience enables her to understand the challenges faced by entrepreneurs. And this is where I'm really fascinated. Due to her extensive research on how asking purposeful questions improves interpersonal and professional connection, Deb has been called the Queen of Questions. I love it. And she's here to share with us her sales experience and just so much that's been going on. She is also the author of a book, and I'm going to get her to talk with you about that. Good morning, Deb. Welcome to the program.
Denise, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, I'm excited. I've been reading your book, which, by the way, audience, is available for the next day or so on Amazon as a free download. Before we get into the program, Deb, send them to your book. It's fascinating. I started reading it last night, and there's a cucumber story that you must share. It started your whole journey with your parents, who, in my opinion, are rock stars. So tell people where to find the book.
Well, the book, as you said, it's free for people listening live. You'll still get in on this through August 3rd, free as a Kindle download on Amazon. And you just have to look for Discover Questions, Get You Connected. When you pull that up, you'll see the paperback copy for sale. You'll also see the Kindle version, and through August 3rd, that's got a zero price tag on it. So, yes, please, come on in and get the book at Amazon.
Excellent. Okay, I've got a ton of questions for you, and I may be peppering you with questions, but mostly I want to just be quiet and let you talk. I don't know if I'm capable of that, but I'm going to try. So we'll see what happens. Okay, so sales. Sales can I don't know, evoke a whole range of emotions in people, can't they? I mean, it's a word that just either makes you go, ooh, or ugh.
And I think more of the latter, the ugh.
Yeah.
It's not only people outside of the profession, even inside the profession of selling, there's so much angst about those stereotypes. And I'd like to say that they're not fair stereotypes, but it isn't just the media that perpetuates those. Sometimes sellers, professional sellers, get it wrong because they think they're supposed to be that manipulative, sleazy, snake oil salesperson. Mm. And I'm so opposed to that. So for anybody listening that doesn't want anything at all to do with sales, you're in the right place because that's not what it's about.
Right. You know, somebody told me once years ago that I was probably the best, I was probably the best natural salesperson that they had ever met, and I came close to hitting him with my car. I was so insulted. I was like, I am not hands on my hip. I stomped off. But as you and I have been talking about, you know, in our green room discussions, this is the age of, you know, really connecting and engaging. You don't need to be in somebody's face holding them by the collar and saying, buy my stuff. I mean, you really want to engage the person that you're dealing with, don't you?
Absolutely. There's this sort of business phrase that I really like. I think it applies to anybody who ever has to sell anything. And it's a choice. It's something you make mentally first. And it's about whether you're going to push your products and services on someone or whether you're going to create a conversation and a connection where they want to pull those from you. In other words, it's about they want them and they are taking them from you willingly and with eagerness as opposed to you forcing them upon somebody who isn't even interested. That's mm-hmm. the big difference.
I'll tell you, one of my big gripes has been for many, many years is MLM people. And I know they're not all like this, but the minute I hear somebody said, would you like to know about a business opportunity in vitamins? I can't get my car keys out quick enough.
You know, I've worked with a number of people in MLM. And the biggest barrier that folks have who are in that world is that they usually have had no other sales training.
Mm.
MLM is pretty far behind the curve in terms of understanding modern buyers. And so they present these scripts, and the training that they have folks go through is highly scripted, highly manipulative.
Oh.
Let me see how I can back you into the corner. And that's why the buyer's remorse, for people who do end up going down that path, the buyer's remorse is often so high because it wasn't something that they internally really were able to believe in. They just felt manipulated into what they purchased.
Well, that makes sense because, I mean, when you can tell, when your spidey sense is going off and you're just saying no, 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 but for whatever reason you get talked into it anyway, that can't end well, can it?
No, and I hate to cast that aspersion across the entire industry.
I'm not, but it just that's what comes to mind. And I've met some people in MLM who are, they know what they're doing. They know that, you know, they can't grab me by the collar. And, you know, they genuinely believe in their product and their service. And I appreciate those people. The ones who grab me literally or figuratively or in a conversation, I'm just pulling away. Don't like
it.
And I don't think most people
like
it. Right.
Yeah, it's the integrity that they're really looking to help you do something that they believe would help you.
Yeah.
But so often it's the opposite. It's the burning desire to win the contest, to make the incentive, to be a part of the club that the MLM is driving. And it's not just MLM. This happens in other sales spheres, too.
Well, I know, and I've seen it, too. And I guess that's why people just go, oh, sales. And I wanted to ask you this, and I have a ton of questions for you. Excuse me. I work in the virtual assistants, online business management, web development arena. Everything I do is online. And constantly I am counseling people in my Facebook group for virtual assistants or even clients who come to me who say, oh, I don't want to sell myself. I mean, you can just feel them shrinking into themselves when I say, listen, you need to be out there letting people know who you are. You need to engage. You need to, you know, you need to be a little bit more visible. And you can just feel them disappearing. They're like, oh, no, 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 I can't do that. And I would love for you to address that.
Yes. It is a common misunderstanding because it's that word sell or selling that turns people off. So let me first come back to a phrase you used, selling yourself, because all too often people think that's what they have to do, that they have to sell out, that they have to, like, sell their soul to the devil kind of a sell.
Mm.
They have to be something that they're not, or they have to push something that people don't want. And in my mind, that's not selling. That's not what I teach. It's not what I believe in. It's just fundamentally the opposite of what I believe it ought to be. selling, and for people that you work with, this hopefully will make a lot more sense. Real, true, genuine selling is about connecting with someone so you can help them. In fact, I believe what modern buyers want is a selling that actually looks more like a servicing. And if you can think about how those things intersect, and the way that you help someone is so often more of a service type of an approach, but that's what connects you to people and helps you to help them with the product or service that you offer.
And see, that makes perfect sense. I mean, you just laid that out brilliantly. So you really want to become a resource, and you want to be able to point them if they ask you for assistance. If you can't help them, you want to be able to point them in another direction, say, well, I can't, but this person can, or this company can. I keep going back in my mind while you're talking to that, you know, the famous Christmas movie Miracle on 34th Street. You know, the scene where the Santa said, well, you know, you can't find that here, but you can go down the street to, I can't remember the name of the store. And instantly customer loyalty went through the roof. And that's how I've always viewed sales. To me, that's how you should do it. Be a resource. Be of service.
I did this just yesterday. Someone who was talking to me and thought he was interested in sponsoring my radio show, and it wasn't the right one. I reach salespeople. He wanted to reach senior-level executives, and I gave him an entirely different resource. Now, will mm-hmm. that earn me a penny? Absolutely not. Did it earn me loyalty and, in fact, another referral that he gave me so that I still had an opportunity to sell something? Yes. And mm-hmm. my brand, my reputation, my ability to sleep at night, my feel good comes from doing the right things for people. And I can be
right.
authentic to myself and still be selling my services.
Exactly. And I think that's so, so, so important, especially in this day of online. Everything is online. I mean, we these days, it is very easy to do business with people we have never met, will never meet, but have really great ongoing relationships with them. So it's not just a one-off thing, is it, where you're just selling something going, hey, thanks for the payment, see ya. I mean, that's not what it's all about at all.
No, and that transactional nature, that gives some salespeople, they interpret it as a permission to churn and burn and not to think about the connection and the relationship. And for most people, that's the turnoff when it comes to selling, is that they aren't viewed as individuals or they aren't given the dignity that they deserve as a buyer.
That's absolutely right. I love that you said that. Okay, I've got to know, how did you become known as the Queen of Questions?
Well, it's a lifetime achievement. It started when I was a kid, and I think I was way beyond the kind of kid who just, as a three-year-old, would say, why, right? All kids do that.
Oh, yeah, I did. I still do.
I had so many questions that my parents would tell me to stop. That's rude. Don't ask those questions. It was always going on all the time.
That.
It just came naturally to me, and I was so extroverted. I wanted to know everything about everybody, and so I would cross the boundary. Well, in high school, I began to find a couple of good paths for places where it was okay to ask questions. So I went into speech and debate, and I went into journalism, and you have to ask questions in both of those arenas. So I'd finally found my outlet. I went ahead and got a journalism degree, got really smart about asking questions, and then ended up in a sales career where I also discovered, hey, if you ask thoughtful questions, if you get really purposeful with your questions, you can do so much more than just these random rapid-fire questions. Now, I have been told in my later years, even though I know better, I was told a couple of years ago that I ought to go get a job at Guantanamo Bay because... because of the
you
nature
go, girl.
Of the questions, we can get really deep really fast. But yeah, the question, it was the title was bestowed upon me, the Queen of Questions, by a customer about 7 years ago. And completely separate from that, twice since, that title has come up. So I've just decided to own it now.
Well, apparently there was some need for that. Now, how do you function with this in your business? Because your business is about helping other people, so did you over time, I guess this is, I have so many questions, my brain is just whirling. Okay, so did you kind of work into that title, or did you know it was always there, and finally you just said, okay, this is going to be part of my business. What I'm going to do with clients is ask these thoughtful questions and measure the responses. And how did you work that into your business? How does it affect your business?
It's been a part of my life, so that's how it became part of my business. When I was first in a sales career, which was a lot of years ago, more than 25 now, but first in a sales career, I went to the library and I found exactly one book in the library shelves about selling. So I checked out that book. I was eager to do a good job. It was a book called Spin Selling, which is probably the best-known book about sales anywhere, and it's a fantastic book based on some great research. But what it does, basically, SPIN is an acronym. It stands for four kinds of questions, and if you ask them in a particular order with a particular agenda in mind, it does help you to move forward in a sale. But it was not satisfying to me. I used it. I liked it. It helped me. But over a short period of time, all those years ago, I realized there were more kinds of questions that were pretty useful. And not all questions fit into those four types. And I wanted to understand why not and what else can questions do. So I just started. As a salesperson, I was writing down these questions, kind of labeling them. If they weren't a spin question, I had question marks beside them. What are they? And then I became a sales manager. I later became a sales trainer. I oversaw more and more salespeople as I went through. And I was scripting all of those sales calls, bucketing all of these questions. I ended up at a Fortune 500 with 31 markets. And so working with trainers in all those places who were also then beginning to collect and assemble questions for me. Then I, at Northwestern University, the Kellogg School, there was a Salesforce Advisory Board. I was a charter member internationally of people who were paying attention to what was effective in selling. So I had all these great resources collecting questions for me. And that's how Discover Questions came about, because I've always used them because I was paying attention to them. And I went back and I took every single one of those questions. I figured out what they were about, and I went back a step. I said, okay, why would someone ask this question? And so I started asking sellers, when you asked this question, what were you hoping to do? What was your intention or your purpose? And then I started talking to buyers about the impact of those questions. And over time, I solidified the eight purposes of asking questions, and I became a lot more purposeful about why I would ask a question and when I would ask it. It was no longer just follow the path out of curiosity. It became a deliberate practice.
Can you give us a for instance?
Sure. So lots of people ask questions because they know they're supposed to, whether it's in casual conversation when you're at a party and you're meeting people, or whether it's in selling. We know that asking questions is a nice thing to do. But we usually end up sort of on a fishing expedition. I just asked that question because I was curious or because it was scripted for me ahead of time or I thought it was a good idea, and then I don't know what to do with it. So let's say you and I were meeting for the first time, Denise, and I would say, so tell me a little bit about your business. Great question, right? Opens up the conversation. But then I don't know where to go. If I didn't have a reason for asking that, my next question might be sort of sloppy. Maybe it's I wasn't even paying attention to what you were saying because I was so busy thinking about my next question. Or I missed something that you shared because I was thinking about the next question or not really paying attention to what you were saying. I had some other agenda. And when we do all of those unintentional behaviors with questions, questions become a negative. But purposefully, if I say, tell me about your business, and then I listen. And if my purpose, let's say, was because I might be considering you as a resource for my business, I know what I'm listening for. I can tune in differently, and my follow-up question will be very different from a fishing expedition would have been.
So you're not just tossing something out and just filling in time. I mean, you're genuinely wanting to know something about the business and you're listening for something that will either move the conversation forward as per your interests, or you can terminate it and go on to something else. Is that about right?
Well said, yes.
Okay. So you really, really do need to, and I find that people don't purposefully listen a lot. I find that just more often than not. So basically, when you're asking a question, whatever that question is, whether it's how's your mom and them, if you live in the Deep South, or if it's a question about your business, you really need to lean into that conversation and pay attention.
Yes, and I love that you used that example, because that question, how are you today, or any mm-hmm. form of it, is such a throwaway question. It's a social nicety, but how often has somebody asked you that question and they pay about zero attention to what you respond?
I know. Yes. Well, here in the South, I mean, we look here, if you say, hey, Denise, how are you doing? I will instantly say, I am well, thank you for asking, and you, because I want to know. You know, you asked me how I was, I'm great, and how are you doing? And it floors me that people never respond. They just, oh, I'm good, and that's it.
Or they do
it
so automated.
And I find that terribly rude.
Notice how often it happens that they say, how are you doing? You say, I'm great, how are you? Oh, I'm good,
mm-hmm.
how are you? It's so automated.
We need to stop that cycle, I'm telling you. So, I'm sorry I interrupted you, but it's really, I've noticed it more and more. It's just people just don't respond to, hey, how are you doing? They're like, that's good. Or worse than that, oh, I had a bad day. Oh, geez, I'm sorry I asked. So, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of automation going on. Okay, so keep on going. Pick up where you were. I'm sorry.
Well, right there. So the connection, right? A question can go one of two directions. It can invite the connection, but in order for us to connect, I have to listen and really respond to what you
mm-hmm.
said, both the words and the emotion, the empathy that could come from how you're responding. And then we have a conversation and a connection. Or it can be scripted and automated, in which case we're going to actually disconnect. It's going to be a barrier to trust, and I'm going to have a reaction, even though I might do it myself and be guilty of doing the same thing. As soon as I felt like you weren't really listening to me, I distance myself. I pull back a little bit from you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an impact.
And this is something that you can teach people to be aware of. I don't know that training would be the right word, but it's more of an awareness, isn't it, of how you're impacting or reacting with or to people. I think people don't understand that we all have at some level a spidey sense, and we kind of get what's going on. We may not react instantly, but at some gut level, we kind of get it, don't we?
Absolutely. What I'm talking about is something that people are either head-bobbing about or shrinking
mm-hmm.
back from because they know it's true, and right. they either agree emphatically or they guiltily have to agree. But it is a choice, I know. And I want to give grace to everybody because we're all so busy and we get caught up in our hurry-up world and
mm-hmm.
it feels like everyone around us is doing exactly the same thing. So we let ourselves off the hook. But it's all about a choice. And the choice is, do I want to connect or not?
Right. And let me ask you this question because I think it's important, and it may be an email etiquette question. But I also think it's a way of connecting with other people because we do so much by email. And it's very easy to just kind of let the niceties go, like, hi, Denise, how are you? Or, hi, Deb, how are you? And you don't need to do that if there's an email string going on. But I see these email strings where they just get terser and shorter and sharper. And I'll tell you what, I don't like them because they're you do lose a connection at some point.
Agreed. And there's always a time when maybe it's better just to pick up the phone. So
yeah.
One of the biggest indicators that this should have been a phone conversation is if the email string is getting longer and longer and each of the responses is getting shorter and shorter, that
mm-hmm.
tells you that there's probably a conversation that could have been a lot more efficient.
Right. So, you know, there are all these just different working components that we need to pay attention to when we're creating these relationships or stepping up to be a resource to people.
Absolutely. And there's subtle signs.
Mm-hmm.
When people are mindful, it is very, very easy to identify when should this be something I focus on just a little bit more so the connection is real and it doesn't feel like a nuisance or it doesn't feel mm-hmm. like it's something that's causing tension as opposed to causing connection. It's the awareness, as you said.
Yeah, good point, awareness. I love that. Okay, so you talked about research. I mean, it looks, you know, when you went into the library and you came to the conclusion that there are really only the 8 purposes for asking questions when you thought there were 4. Do you mind sharing some of those 8 purposes, or would you rather people read the book?
Oh, no, I don't mind sharing at all. I'll go through them quickly.
Okay.
And here's what's interesting. So I say there are 8 purposes, and I have now spent more than a decade looking for a 9th purpose, an outlying purpose. There's got to be something else because 8 is such a small number. But whether it's in selling or coaching or personal one-on-one relationships, I've looked in all these arenas, and every single question I've heard for the past 10 years is one of these 8 purposes. So that's all there is. I'm convinced. And the reason I was looking for a 9th, this is, I'll tell you this, Denise, it's a little bit embarrassing because it's the tail wagging the dog, but the reason I was looking for a 9th purpose is that I formed the acronym DISCOVER. Every letter of the word DISCOVER, all 8 of those letters, stand for a different kind of question, which I'll tell you about in just a moment. But since that's a verb, it's not really an adjective or a noun, people, when they talk about discover questions, they usually remember it as discovery questions with a Y. So mm-hmm. I really wanted to find a 9th question that I could name with the Y and make it discovery questions.
You. It's all about you.
Exactly, something. But there is no 9th question, so I can't do it. 9th purpose. So
we'll
it is discover questions, and these are the 8. We have to live with them. Okay, so I'll give you a couple at a time and talk about them briefly. The first one, the D in Discover, stands for data. And we all ask a lot of these questions. These are the, you know, just give me the facts kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a data question when your purpose is to get to something that's proven. It's absolutely objective. It's a fact. There's not any two ways about it. There's no opinion. So a data question would be something like, Denise, how long have you been in business?
Okay, got it.
Yeah, that is a fact. The I question issue is the only one that's actually about the person asking the question or about the relationship between the person asking the question and the other party. So the I stands for issue. In business, it's really sort of a service-oriented question. It's something that would sound like if it were reactive because you told me there's a problem with our relationship, I would say something like, you know, tell me more. How can I make that better?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question that's extremely good at connecting people, unlike a data question, which is really just the facts and there's not a lot of interest stimulated by that, not a lot of depth of relationship to it. But an issue question is just the opposite. When I ask you that kind of a question, it signifies that I care, and we're going to make things right between us. So that's issue. There's another nuance to issue. I gave you the reactive because if you tell me there's a problem, I want to probe into that. But mm-hmm. there's also a proactive way. I might say to you if we're in business, tell me your preferences about communication. And by doing that, I head off any problems in our relationship. I think about what's going to satisfy you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So those are actually the two easiest kinds of questions. Issue questions are far less often used, so they're, for some people, new kinds of questions to think about asking. But once they get the hang of issue questions, they're super easy to use.
And here's the thought, too. When you hear the word issue, you always, I don't know about you, I always think, uh-oh, not good. It could be negative. So could that be part of why they're not asked?
Well, yeah, we all dodge, right? If somebody says, unless you work on a customer service desk and are accustomed to this every day, if somebody says they're not happy with something about you mm-hmm. in a relationship or in a professional setting, our defenses go up. We want to duck and dodge that conversation. Many people are conflict averse. So our response to that is not usually a tell me more kind of question. But when you do that, when you give the other party a chance to be heard, to vent, to give you more information that you can respond to intelligently, it changes the relationship. That's where the connection comes from.
It does, and I can tell you that from very recent personal experience, because I have one huge website we just launched, and towards the end there, it got just a little bit tense between me and the client, because she is a she's a lovely person, but she's also a very emotional person, and I'm not. And I have a hard time understanding people who what-if themselves to death, and I finally just told her that. And, you know, that kind of brought me back to the email thing, because, again, I'm speaking from personal experience. We were getting terser and terser and terser. Finally, we just picked up the phone and had that conversation. And it was going to be a half-hour conversation where we sorted it out and apologized if we needed to. 4 hours later, we're best friends. We had the best conversation. 5 hours before that, I was ready to choke her. So sometimes, and she was probably ready to come hit me with something. I mean, it wasn't going well. So we said, stop, just stop. We're going to fix this. And we did, and I'm so glad we did.
And you probably asked an issue question that, for you at least at first, might have been a little bit uncomfortable. And if not for you, because different people have different personalities. Yes.
Very.
But yeah, many people
I'm not a fuzzy thinker, and, you know, I'm not a what-if thinker. I'm logical and linear, and I don't understand putting yourself into a position where you just what-if yourself into a corner. And bless her heart, that's what was happening. And once we finally figured that out, she said, oh, okay. And we worked out just a whole lot, and it just really ended well, and I'm so grateful for that.
Well, kudos to you for a smart use of an issue question.
I didn't know it was an issue question. I just thought I needed to apologize until I was blue in the face. But whatever it was. And I'm glad to know that it was an issue question. I didn't realize that.
Well, those are powerful questions, and they make a lot of difference in relationships. The next one, the solution question, which is the S in Discover, also tends to really be uncommonly used. But once people use it and know about it, it unleashes all kinds of ideas and really helps to move things forward in relationships and in sales. So this is a very powerful one for anybody who's in sales. And I find that people who are a little bit uncomfortable at that moment of time when they need to sort of move toward closing the sale or getting
mm-hmm.
some progress forward, this is a great question that can be very helpful without feeling salesy and not manipulative at all. So a solution question, the reason that you would use this is when you want to early on plant some seeds, get some ideas generated, get an initial reaction to an idea that you have, and you want to start the other person thinking about something they weren't thinking about before. Later on, let's say it's time to close a sale or to make a decision to move forward in our conversation, you would just lay it out there as a, you know, tell me, what do you think about this idea? And you'd lay out the idea, and you'd either have somebody agreeing or disagreeing, and then you'd know where it stands
mm-hmm.
so that you don't have to put too much lock, stock, and barrel into it at a point it's too late.
Okay.
So it's a question that invites alternatives, and it also invites some great brainstorming so you can collaborate in that sales process or in that relationship.
Well, and that makes perfect sense because you're not just offering them one or two solutions. You're now listening and saying, okay, if the solution that I have proffered is not a good fit for you, where can we kind of tailor make it and make it fit for you to where you're very happy and it does your business some good?
Oh, you're a natural, yes. That's exactly
oh.
it.
Okay. And that leads me to my next question, Deb. Are these questions, to me, a lot of them seem instinctual.
Well, you said the keywords in what you said are to me. So you probably have a little bit of a gift in terms of being able to empathize and consider the weight of your words and how people will respond to them. Not everybody has that. In fact,
okay.
in my observations over the last 25 years, more people don't have that, especially when they're driven by some other factor, like I've got to make the sale
mm-hmm.
or I need
mm-hmm.
to make this person understand my point of view. And when those things get in the way, the part that you're describing, that the instinctual part, the listening to what's happening in the moment and responding naturally, that gets lost.
Hmm. Is this something that can be learned?
Absolutely. It's a skill. It's something that you practice. It's something that does come more and more naturally once you understand it and start to use it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I can see why it would, because once you understand, and it's hard for people to understand that what they're doing so hard, and, you know, this is the way they've always done it, or this is the way they're trained to do it, and it's simply not working. And once they kind of have to step away from that thought process and move into a whole different thought process, which can be tough, but once they see the benefits of it, I would think over time it would become second nature, almost like breathing.
Exactly. I'm glad you said that, because that's an analogy that I often use. See, people, the biggest barrier to using questions with purpose, the biggest barrier is that people say, what do you mean I have to pay attention to asking questions? It comes just as naturally as breathing,
right,
which you just brought to the table. Well, so here's the thing. We do. We breathe naturally, but when we're going to do certain activities, like childbirth or yoga or running or swimming or relaxing, all those activities can be done better if you adapt the way that you're breathing during the activity. And the very same thing is true with questions. If you adapt and stay mindful of the way you're asking questions, you can get better results in certain activities. And that's all it is. It's just like being mindful of how you breathe, being mindful of how you ask questions can have extremely different results for you.
And I think being mindful of how you listen to those questions as well. I mean,
yes,
actually take the time to listen and don't interrupt is sometimes your best bet.
I agree. They go hand in hand.
Yeah, and that's tough. Not interrupting, that's a tough thing, isn't it?
It is. It is, especially when you've got so much to say and you're very excited about a topic.
Right, right. I love this. I'm having so much fun with this. Okay, so now I've been going through your book. I haven't made it all the way to the end, but it's on my weekend reading list. I read a lot. I love, love, love to read, and you should see it. I've already bookmarked all kinds of places on my Kindle. But I know this book is written for sales professionals, but what I'm finding in the book is that you don't have to be a sales professional to benefit from these eight purposes, really. And again, that goes back to kind of what I'm talking about in my industries. And anybody who is an online entrepreneur or thinking of being one, or anybody who has the downtown corner drugstore, I mean, who you're selling to, who you're talking to, is your fellow man. It just seems to me it would behoove you to learn how to get along with your fellow man.
And so it does say for professional sellers, but if we were to identify who that really is, well, it's every small business owner.
Right.
It's everybody who has ideas and wants to be influential in sharing those ideas and into getting buy-in into those ideas. This is book one in the series, and the later books are for coaches, trainers, managers, and leaders. But there are, with all five of those big, broad categories, there are lots and lots of offshoots. And the only thing that changes from one book to the next, it's not the eight purposes of questions. It's only going to be the examples that I use and the application. Because I've done all this research, I have this wealth of examples that I need to put somewhere. And so I'm just going to continue to make it more tailored for each of those audiences.
Mm-hmm.
But even this book, the first one, can be very relevant for just about anyone.
Well, everybody who's listening, grab this book. I mean, I grabbed it. I saw it before it became available as a download, and for whatever reason, I didn't buy it. And then when I understood it was going to become free, I went, ooh, and I put it on my calendar. I seriously put it on my calendar. I wanted this book. Can I ask you a quick question about the proper sequencing of questions? It's a little bit, you know, away from what we've been talking about, but that's the chapter I have open right now. Do you mind, you know, kind of explaining what the proper sequencing of questions is?
Yes. This is something that derails a lot of conversations and a lot of sales conversations in particular, because we go into conversations with our own agenda. Like it or not, that's just the truth of it. Sellers go into a conversation with the agenda to sell something, to close the sale, to move it forward, make a commission. And so they sometimes get ahead of themselves. They will ask questions that are perfectly good questions, but they might be premature. And the proper sequencing of questions is about which ones do you ask first so that you can build up to a time when it's more natural and more useful to ask those kinds of questions. So let me give you first a sales example, then I'll make it a little broader. One question that I hear very often, way too early in sales meetings, is, what's your budget? Now, that's not a bad question. It's a bad question when it's asked at the wrong time. It's none of your business what my budget is if I'm not even sure that I want to buy something with you and make an investment. It isn't something that I'm prepared to talk about and probably haven't given thought to until I see the value of whatever it is you're going to offer to me. So it derails the communication, and it might even be so off-putting that I close off to the salesperson because of that question. But later on, after you've asked about my needs, after you've asked me some of those solution questions, so we've done some brainstorming and some co-creating of what that solution could look like, after we've had an opportunity to work through some questions around issues that I have and potential barriers that I might be experiencing, then as we're getting very close to the end of our whole process in buying and selling, then to ask me, okay, then, given everything we've discussed, what's your budget? What are you anticipating here? That's appropriate, but only at that time. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to me, if somebody asks that question straight out of the chute, and again, you haven't established what needs to be done or where the true interest lies, I think that's a conversation ender just about. The conversation may go on, but I think it's limping along at that point.
Yes. So in a sales training class one time, someone likened this to something we can all envision, and so I really like this non-sales example. It would be the equivalent, to ask questions out of sequence, it would be the equivalent of walking up to a complete stranger and saying, will you marry me? Before you say, what's your name, what are your hobbies,
right,
and so on and so on. There are many questions in the sequence that come before, will you marry me?
No kidding. Okay, so is there anything else in this particular sequence that we need to know about?
Well, the early questions, the ones that you ask that are very broad and open-ended, they establish trust. They give you a chance to really know someone and to understand what motivates them, what's most important to them. So, yes, those questions early on ought to be big and broad and wide open. And then as you, if you can envision a funnel, as you get narrower in the funnel, your questions also get narrower. They might be more about close-ended kinds of questions, yes-no answers that give you confirmation on key points.
Okay, great. Okay, out of the eight questions, which is your favorite?
Oh, my favorite by far and away is the V. That's a value question. It's a question that helps me to understand what matters most to the person I'm talking about. Because in any conversation, we might be all over the board talking about many different topics. If I'm listening closely, I'll probably pick up on some subtle cues based on the emotionality that you convey.
Mm-hmm.
But I might not, I might be assuming, I might not get it just right. So a value question helps me to know what matters most to you. And in sales, this is going to help me then to propose something or to follow up with you on the thing that you care about as a priority. In real life, I'll give you an example of a value question that really hit home with me. About a year ago now, I was changing the place where I got my hair done. I have this curly, crazy hair.
Me too.
And,
yeah.
I call
it
about how we're probably long-lost sisters.
Yeah. It's terrorist hair. You cannot look elegant or well put together if you have a mop of curly hair. You have this, you know, great couture outfit, but if your hair looks like you're pulled backwards through a fence, it kind of ruins the look.
Yes, it does. So I've been living all my years with my crazy curly hair, and as I've begun to do more keynote speaking and onstage type stuff, I was feeling like I wanted to sometimes have a more so-called professional look. And I wasn't getting it with the person that I'd been seeing for years, wonderful person. So I went to another hairdresser who I didn't know, but she offered free consultations.
Oh.
And I was in her chair for no more than about 5 minutes before she asked me a couple of these value questions, trying to get at my priorities. And I still see her a year later. I spend a lot more money than I ever used to on my hair and a lot more time. But the conversation kind of went like this. Cherise said to me, so, you know, what is it that you want to accomplish? And I was explaining to her more professional look. And she asked me, well, how much time do you want to spend on your hair? And I said, oh, you know, 5 minutes max. I'm so busy. And
been
she
there,
stepped
done
back.
That.
Oh, yeah. She stepped back from me and she said, okay, well, tell me what's more important to you, the amount of time you spend on your hair or the way that you have that professional image that you were describing.
Mm,
and I
gotcha.
Had to admit, I know.
Yeah.
She made me pick.
That's just it. It's so easy to throw your hair up in a ponytail. I do it all the time. Ponytail is my friend.
Enough, but it's so thick that I can't quite do that. But
all right.
Yes. It's easy to wash and go and blame it on the curls is what it is.
Exactly, exactly. So that was a great question. She was able to stand back. She had listened to you. She knew that you wanted a professional look, but she wasn't going to give you an out on it. You know, she needed you to understand that if you wanted this professional look, there were going to be steps involved, and you were going to have to agree to take these steps, right?
Exactly. Otherwise, I was asking her to do the impossible. And
right. She wasn't going
to
go down that road with you. Excellent. Excellent. Okay, so one thing that we talked about in the green room, you said that questions are misunderstood and they're underutilized, and I think we covered this a bit. Do you want to kind of expand on that? Because I think it's so, so important. We do have to ask questions, not personal questions. I don't know about you. People ask me personal questions. I simply don't answer them. My personal life is just that. It's personal. But I have found in certain sales situations where people want to ask me what I consider extraordinarily personal questions. What is that all about?
Well, okay. So what that's all about is the misunderstanding of what relationship selling is. Relationship selling, the concept behind it is very good. It says we'll buy from people we know and trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true.
Right.
But knowing and trusting someone has a lot more to do with what they can offer us, what product or service and solution they can bring us, and we can trust in them as an expert. That's what it's really all about. It's not all about, I got the goods on you and I know your personal life, and so now automatically mm-hmm. we have to be friends and you have to buy from me. That misunderstanding is something that many sellers just don't quite get because it's cheaper and easier to ask the same kinds of questions that you'd ask your fraternity brother than it is to step up and show the business literacy and the insight into your business and have us establish our trust and relationship around that.
There you go. When you're coaching, you know, when you're in front of a group, let's say that a company has brought you in to kind of help with their sales force, what are some of the common questions? I mean, are they part of these questions that are in your book, or there's some that every once in a while you say, that one came out of left field. But what is the most common thing, I guess, my question is for people who are in a sales force, is it the fact that they have to be competitive with one another, or what's going on? It's a mindset, isn't it? What's going on with them where you can really, really step up and help them change how they view the consumer and how they can relate to the consumer?
Yes, it's
Did
all
that even
about
make sense?
Intention.
I was rambling there.
I think so. You tell me if I don't quite get to what you were looking for, and then we'll get more purposeful with the question.
There you go.
Well, I think what you asked me is what keeps a seller from naturally entering into the sales relationship in a way that's going to give them a connection.
Yeah, because, I mean, so many people are, you know, they're sent out there with scripts, and they're sent out there with old programming, so to speak. And then they can't figure out why they can't win those sales awards or why they can't close the sale. For some reason, I'm thinking of an insurance salesman. I don't know
why. It's all about the intention. So in a salesperson's world, first of all, it's a really hard job, and it's a noble profession, and there's so much that they have to deal with. One of the things they have to deal with is the daily pressure that they get from sales managers and from sales quotas and from things that are happening mm-hmm. inside the sales organization, drive, 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 get to that goal, get to that number, get to your commission, because maybe you don't even make a penny unless you get to your goal.
Ow.
They've got that coming from inside their organization, and then they have their buyers who they have relationships with. And if you can imagine having, let's say you have 50 customers that you work with, that's 50 relationships you have to maintain, plus everything that's going inside your organization and all that pressure. It's tremendous.
So I would think. It's not something I don't think I know I couldn't do it.
It's hard. It's very hard
yeah.
for people to put themselves in that role. But the seller, right, the place where this doesn't work is when they allow their focus to become the number. No matter what pressure they're getting internally, the focus can never be, I've got to close the sale.
Mm-hmm.
That's important, and it will happen. It's counterintuitive. You will close the sale. You will make your numbers. You will achieve goal if you keep the customer's needs front and center and your intentions are not how fast can I close the sale, but your intentions are how well can I meet the needs of this customer.
Oh, that is beautiful. I see this all of the time in the VA industry. It'll pop up in my group, my Facebook group. It's like, oh, I really need the money. Should I take this client? And all I can say is no. No, you never take a client just because you need the money. You need to step back and find out how you can really, really serve this person. They're not just a client. They're not a customer, a consumer. They're a person with a business. They have real needs. Can you genuinely serve them? Can you genuinely provide what they need? If you're just trying to meet your monthly retainer quota, walk away, please. Do everybody, you and the client, a huge favor and either reassess what's going on, rework it with the client, or walk off. Am I just dead wrong there?
No, you're absolutely right, because that's so short term. You could take the client now, but at
right.
what cost? Your brand, your reputation,
mm-hmm.
your image, the fact that they're going to be dissatisfied and might not want to pay you when it's all said and done anyway, the way you're going to feel when your day is done and you know you haven't done work that you can be proud of,
right.
it's just not worth it.
It really isn't. And I get why people can think like that, but short-sighted is an excellent way of describing it. It's just a terrible thing to do, both to you and to them. And here's what I find. The nature abhors a vacuum. If you just calm down and really serve as best as you can, things come to you. People come to you. It's just nature.
It's the law of attraction. You've got to be
yes,
attractive
that's exactly
in the
right.
way that you do business. Yes.
Right. That's exactly right. And I will tell people all the time, listen, if you've got a client that for whatever reasons you're just not a good fit, find somebody else, that, you know, refer him or her to somebody else. And then don't panic, because somebody perfect will come along to fill that slot. And a lot of people are like, oh, no, I've got to make the money now, and I can't preach it enough. Just calm down. Do your absolute best work. People will refer you like crazy. But if you're just taking money for hours, you're not going to get referrals. You're not going to get repeat business. You're going to wind up with a lousy reputation and probably stomach ulcers. Stop it.
Couldn't
so I preach
more.
That a lot.
Wise words.
No good. Sometimes I feel mean when I say, no, don't do that. But, you know, okay, so what happens when people begin actually purposefully using these 8 questions? And they really kind of say, okay, I'm going to back down from my old sales training, or I must get the sale today. I must. I've got a car note due. What happens to them, and this is kind of a metaphysical question perhaps, but I have no question at all that their business, you know, their dollars in the column, you know, just kind of add up, but what happens to them on a physical and personal level? I'm willing to bet that all of a sudden they just feel much better about everything.
They do. There are 4 big shifts, and the first one
oh.
is what you just described. People come back to me. I love this. It's just the icing on the cake. They come back to me over and over again, and they say, wow, this has really helped me in my business and in my sales, but it helps me in my relationships. I've even had more than one person come to me and say, you saved my marriage.
Oh.
And I love that. Or
nice.
Recently someone said, hey, I can actually get my teenager talking to me now. Thank you.
So these are emotional skills, aren't they? I mean, it's not just tactics or something that you write down on paper and you go, I'm going to do it this way. You're actually tapping into who you are and who the people you're dealing with are.
Yes. And you're giving dignity back to people. You're giving so much to them because, really, good questions, they create value. They create connection and meaningful value out of thin air. They just bring something into the world that was never there before.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, so what else happens?
Oh, so that's the first shift. The second shift is the obvious one. I'm selling more. So I can see it on my bottom line. The third shift I usually hear reported comes from the sales managers. I can't believe how different this salesperson is. And the fourth one, because I go back and I interview buyers after training, and I do a lot of field coaching, so I get to know buyers, and they say things like, this is the one salesperson that I will always take a phone call from now. Those questions really helped my business. They made me think. I'm better because of those questions that so-and-so asked me.
That has got to make you feel really good about your life's work.
It does.
I would think so. So the shift is not just in sales. The shift is in values.
And in communication and in
connection. Right.
People are genuinely bonded because of good questions.
You know, and this is something that, I'm going to go back to your hairdresser, this is not something you can do in 5 minutes. I mean, they have to actually sit down, learn to be mindful, learn to be patient. What are some of the things that you tell people when they're first starting on this new journey? Because it sounds like a very new journey. What are some of the cautions that you may give them? And what are some of the things that you say, listen, you can do this, and this is how you can do it?
Practice. So the biggest caution is don't expect there to be an overnight change, but practice.
Mm-hmm.
Give it that 15 to 30 days it takes to form new habits. And I give people, in the hard copy book, there's a whole section on skills practice, and it tells people things like, here's how you can be a question detective and just start becoming all the more thoughtful about going out and paying attention to questions people ask and what those questions yield. So don't be impatient. But I want to backtrack something you said, which is you can't do it in 5 minutes. Well, you can't learn it and get good at it and expect it to be done in 5 minutes when you're new to this. But absolutely, after a few weeks, that first question you ask, opening up a sale, talking to someone brand new, yes, you can make a difference. And I get through to a lot more decision makers, and I have more conversations from a first phone call than just about anybody I know. And the thing I love when people say to me in just about any conversation, I look for this because it feeds me. People say to me, wow, that's a good question. And they lean in and they connect with me. They make eye contact. Their wheels are turning. And there's just something almost magical when I hear somebody say that and that body language and everything that changes in the relationship. I do this on airplanes all the time when I'm meeting people. It's just a fun thing to do. But it validates for me that, yes, this question, these kinds of questions, this intentionality behind questions, it really matters.
And I'm willing to bet you can do this on the phone, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You can do it in emails. You want to increase the responses that you get to your emails? Just put a good question, a compelling question that people feel like they want to think about and want to answer. You'll get a return reply.
It really is all about relationship building, isn't it? And not fake faux. It's really about you being genuinely interested in what the other person has to say.
Yes. It is.
This has been so much fun, and you know we're darn near out of time. So, Deb, what's up next in the series, and how can listeners get in on the Discover Questions?
Well,
oh, and you have a podcast, too. I want you to share that as well.
Okay. For professional sellers, we have a podcast. It's called Connect Online Radio. It's right here on Blog Talk. The Discover Questions series is going to have some offshoots from the Professional Sellers book, so getting down into very specific industries. But then the next full book, which will be released by the end of the year, is for people in business coaching. So that's going to have its own offshoots and keep growing from there.
Okay.
To follow all of this, if once people read the book, inside the e-book, they'll find that there's a LinkedIn group they can come be a part of. On our website, People First PS, the words People First are spelled out. The PS stands for Productivity Solutions. They can come there, and there's always something new in the blogs and elsewhere that keep this alive. And I really do love to connect with people. So I hope as folks are reading the book and understanding Discover Questions that they'll be in touch, and
mm-hmm.
I can hear from them what's happening too.
I didn't realize you had a LinkedIn group. So as soon as I get to that point in the book, I'm heading over there. Are there any plans to have a Facebook group?
That's a great idea. I haven't done it yet.
I'll tell you what, mine. Yeah, I can. My Facebook group is phenomenal. I mean, these people step up and they help each other every day. We all learn something new every day. It's a great, great place to learn and visit and share triumphs and, you know, jump over hurdles. So Facebook, I would. If you have a group, I would love to join it. Or I can set one up for you. I can sure help you with that. But I find that Facebook and LinkedIn, the way people kind of respond to you are different in both groups. You need both. But it's a little more relaxed in Facebook, I find.
I like the idea.
Yeah. I'll be your first member. I'll be the gold member or the platinum member. I'll be over there with my hands up. Okay, well, listen, tell people one more time where they can find you.
Okay, the website is peoplefirstps.com. Stands for People First Productivity Solutions. First two words are spelled out. The PS is just like you put at the end of an old school letter.
Okay. And everybody, go to Amazon and grab this book. Deb, tell people the title one more time. Look, I downloaded it. When did it come free? 2 days ago? 3 days ago?
Yes. It's a 5-day free sale. So it started on Wednesday and it ends on Sunday, August 3rd. It's called Discover Questions, Get You Connected.
We didn't get a chance to do the cucumber story. Listen, we're not streaming anymore, but we're still recording. You've got to tell people how you started this journey.
Well, my sales journey, I think my parents, I know my dad, he really had a mindset that he wanted us to have some core skills growing up. And one of those fundamental skills was that we should know how to sell things. So we had a great big garden in our backyard and a surplus of cucumbers when I was 7 years old. He loaded up my little red wagon with cucumbers and a few green peppers and tomatoes, and he said, go out in the neighborhood. Everything in here costs a nickel. Don't take any wooden nickels, but don't come home till you sell everything. And it was hot. It was August. This is in Kansas City, Missouri, humid, and I was 7, going door to door. And it was lonely, and I didn't like being alone. I very much wanted other people around me. So when a friend rode by on her bicycle, I suggested that she come along with me. We sell everything together, and we'd split the money. We did that. It took us a while, but we sold every vegetable in the red wagon. We split the money, and we immediately went to a little convenience store just down the road and spent all our money on popsicles or something.
Well, yeah. You're 7.
Exactly. So then I went home, told my dad the wagon's empty. I made this money. I gave half of it to my friend. And that was my first sales training 101, which was all about, hey, you don't split the top line revenue. You've been out there watering the garden. You're the person who was out there with the product, and it was your product. You've done all the fertilizing. You've had to pull the weeds. You're the one who should have had more of the money, and if you're hiring some help, it's not a 50-50 split. And even at age 7, he was explaining this to me. I got it. You know, it was like my first lesson in real business. And it went from there. But cucumbers, that's the first thing I remember selling.
It was, and I had two very, very different reactions to that, all in, you know, half a second, because I'm a speed reader. I'm reading this going, oh, that was really smart of her to get help. But then I got to the part where you split it, and I went, hold on a second. Hang on. You know, how much did she sell before the friend got there? Had she sold a third? Wait a second here. I was doing math in my head. And then, because I thought, oh, that's just really brilliant. And then when by the time I got to your dad, I went, uh-huh. You know, I was agreeing with your dad. So, it was just in one paragraph, I had all these conflicting emotions, like, oh, she was right. Oh, bad idea. Oh, shoot, dad's spot on. So anyway, I love that story, and I thought they gave you just a great, great grounding.
They did. I was very fortunate. Both my parents were Marine Corps drill sergeants, and so we got lots of interesting lessons growing up.
I bet you did. Well, listen, everybody, grab the book. I'm telling you, it's not just for sales professional. I think it's just everything that's laid out in there, as far as I can tell. What I've read really can stand you in good stead across your life. We sell every day. We do. We have to write resumes. We have to sell the fact to our husband that we didn't mean to scratch that car. We sell all day long. You might as well learn how to do it properly. Deb, thanks so much for being with me here today. You gave our audience a glimpse into your life and your systems and your thought processes, and I know they appreciate it as much as I do. And I had a great time chatting with you.
Me too, Denise. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here with you.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Well, listen, everybody, the show will be available for download in about an hour, and you can also find us in iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Deb Calvert. Grab her book, and I will see you next week. Thank you, everybody.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottogovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.